This morning's scripture comes from 2 Kings chapter 5, verses 1 through 14, and this is the message rendering of that story. Naaman was general of the army under the king of Aram. He was important to his master, who held him in the highest esteem because it was by him that God had given victory to Aram. He was a truly great man, but afflicted with a grievous skin disease. It so happened that Aram, on one of its raiding expeditions against Israel, captured a young girl who became a maid to Naaman's wife. One day she said to her mistress, "Well, if only my master could meet the prophet of Samaria, he would be healed of his skin disease." Naaman went straight to his master and reported what the girl from Israel had said. "Well, then go," said the king of Aram. "I'll send a letter of introduction to the king of Israel." So he went off, taking with him about 750 pounds of silver, 150 pounds of gold, and 10 sets of clothes. Naaman delivered a letter to the king of Israel. The letter read, "When you get this letter, you'll know that I've personally sent my servant Naaman to you. Heal him of his skin disease." When the king of Israel read the letter, he was terribly upset. Ripping his robe to pieces, he said, "Am I a god with the power to bring death or life that I get orders to heal this man from his disease? What's going on here? That king's trying to pick a fight, that's what." Elisha, the man of God, heard what had happened, that the king of Israel was so distressed that he'd ripped his robe to shreds. He sent word to the king, "Why are you so upset, ripping your robe like that? Send him to me so he'll learn that there's a prophet in Israel." So Naaman, with his horses and chariots, arrived in style and stopped at Elisha's door. Elisha sent out a servant to meet him with the message, "Go to the river Jordan. Immerse yourself 7 times. Your skin will be healed and you'll be as good as new." Naaman lost his temper. He turned on his heel, saying, "I thought he'd personally come out and meet me, call on the name of the Lord, wave his hand over the diseased spot, and get rid of the disease. The Damascus rivers of Abana and Pharpar are cleaner by far than any of the rivers in Israel. Why not bathe in them? I'd at least get clean." And he stomped off, mad as a hornet. But his servants caught up with him and said, "Father, if the prophet had asked you to do something hard and heroic, wouldn't you have done it? So why not this simple wash and be clean?" So he did it. He went down and immersed himself in the Jordan 7 times, following the orders of the holy man. His skin was healed. It's like the skin of a little baby. It was as good as new. Over the past 15 years, I've watched a phenomenon grow that has helped shape the way we live in this country. I'm talking about the rise of the popularity of bottled water. It's become pervasive, if not ubiquitous, in our society. I'd venture to guess there are more than a few of you here who either have a bottle of water beside you this morning, or at your feet this morning, or maybe in your purse. A man purse or a woman purse, whichever it might be. And don't misunderstand, I'm not here to judge about that. I'm not concerned about folks bringing drinks into the sanctuary. There are some who might be, but I'm not. In fact, I'm just glad you're here. And if I could get more people to come by bringing their drinks into the sanctuary, I'd go around and pour each of you a cup of coffee myself during worship. But I digress. Let me keep back to my focus. Our habits have made the bottled water industry a financial juggernaut. Statistics show us that every year in this country, we buy 30 billion, that's billion with a B, as Carl Sagan would say, 30 billion bottles of water in this country, spending $12 billion to buy them. In the U.S., it averages out to more than 167 bottles a year for every man, woman, and child in our nation. And if you don't personally drink 167 bottles, and I don't, somebody's drinking more than that to cover our slacking off. So, based on sales, we know our favorites are Aquafina, made by Pepsi-Cola, Dasani made by Coca-Cola, Pure Life made by Nestle, Evian, Fiji Natural Artesian Water, Mountain Valley Spring Water, Perrier, and there's even one called Trump Ice, made by you-know-who. And there are probably as many reasons for buying bottled water as there are people who drink it. There's the issue of safety. In some places, the water is just not safe. That's more true around the world than it is in our own nation, but it even happens here. There's the issue of consistent quality. We've seen that from one municipal water system to another. What happened in Flint, Michigan 6 weeks ago is just the most recent thing that's taken our attention. In disaster areas, bottled water has proven to be a literal lifesaver. As you think back to Hurricane Katrina in Louisiana, and you saw all the images on the news for the Haiti earthquakes, and you saw thousands of pallets where the bottled water sat at the airports waiting to be distributed, but that didn't come in a timely fashion. People buy bottled water for convenience sake. It fits well into our complex and rushed lifestyles. There are even some people and some brands of bottled water that feed our need for image. You know, some that just really have that connection. That's fancy water, so I'm a fancy person. That's not true of your brand, I'm sure. The big players in this industry wage designer water wars on each other every single day. But then, why should this surprise us? Designer water wars aren't new with us. You can see it in this story this morning. As Naaman comes for healing and Elisha gives the prescription to go and bathe in the Jordan River, and Naaman says, "That stuff's a mess. I'll go home. My water's better than your water." There's so much to be said about this story. It's about many things. This story is about need. Naaman had a need, a severe skin disease that had obviously been a scourge for him for years in his life, that had shaped his life, that had caused him different levels of isolation, even a sense of embarrassment and personal shame. It was severe enough that others knew about it, severe enough that his wife's maid, slave maid, saw and heard conversations and said, "If only the master would go and see this prophet in Samaria, he would be healed." Severe enough that when he heard she had said that, he ran to the king. You don't show your weaknesses to your boss. He ran to the king, so the king obviously knew already about the need and said, "They say I can go there and find healing." And the king says, "Go. Let me write a letter of introduction." And he sent with him royal gifts. It's a story about need. This is a story about politics. Naaman comes with this letter from the king of Aram and gives it to the king of Israel, and the king of Israel reads it as something that it is not. Not without fault for that. I mean, there's a possibility he could think that because Aram had spent so many times raiding into Israel again and again and again, now it sounded like they wanted to come to get it all. And he's provoking a war. It's a story about healing, about God's healing of Naaman through God's prophet of Elisha. It's a story about two very strong personalities. There is this important general, Naaman, who is said to be a great man, who is the right hand of the king, and this unimpressed, curmudgeon, hermit, prophet, Elisha, who didn't care what anybody thought of him, including his own king, who didn't like people at all. Talk about a great pastor. Well, he wasn't a pastor, he was a prophet. He didn't like people at all. And by the way, didn't take it well when people called him bald. But that's a story from the day, if you want to read about that. Story about strong personalities. It's a story about expectations and failed expectations. Naaman had envisioned this moment for so long. desperately seeking healing. And then when he finally heard there was healing possibly out there, he had it all pictured out how it should go and how it would go. And when he finally got to this man, as he pulled up his whole entourage, his horses and chariots and the men in attendance with all that, pulled up in style, it said, he pulled up to what was basically a shack, a hovel. And when Elisha, the prophet, sent out his servant with the directions, that wasn't how it was supposed to go. Naaman knew that he should come out and meet him because he was important. He knew that he should come out and call upon the name of the Lord and wave his hand over the diseased spot. This is all that Naaman had scripted for this, and it didn't go that way at all. And then this servant who comes, you don't send a servant to an important person, and gives him the instructions to go and to bathe in a muddy creek in comparison to the rivers of Damascus. And so Naaman's expectations were not met, and his reaction showed that. The funny thing is, I don't think Elisha was trying to embarrass or slight or anger Naaman at all. I think just as Elisha was a matter-of-fact kind of guy with no social skills, no tact, no interest in stroking anybody's ego, he just said, I know your need, I got the prescription for the cure, and he sent his servant out with it. And in a way, then, it's about designer water wars. You know, the rivers of Damascus are clear and sparkling. And the river of Jordan is just this runoff from an almost mountain in the northern part of Israel. If that's all it takes, I'll stay home and wash in mine. I'll get clean that way. My water's better than your water, and I'm better than you. And mainly I think the designer water wars translate into the story being about pride. That sense of self-importance and the danger that it poses in our lives. You see, pride's about, or rather, pride denies community. Pride says, I'm better than other people. I'm better than you. I'm more important than other people. I can do it on my own, even when obviously I can't. I still say that I can. Pride says, who do you think you are? I'm more important than that. You should come out and meet me in person. Pride destroys community. At some point, if I feel my sense of importance has been threatened, I withdraw from those who threaten me, and so I stand alone, and I am no longer part of community. C.S. Lewis called pride a spiritual cancer that eats up love and contentment. Pride isolates, leaving us alone and in need without healing. Unfortunately, most of us have known somebody in our lives who has felt like, acted like Naaman. Don't name names, don't point. Somebody who has been so self-important, not the self-assured and confident person that we admire, but self-important at the point of making the other less important. Those kinds of people can ruin a conversation and clear a room pretty quickly. After a while, nobody wants to be around them at all. They have few or no real friends, but that's okay because they don't need them. When life gets bigger than they are, and life always gets bigger than we are at some point, they're left alone. And now for the risky question. Have you ever felt like, acted like Naaman? If you have, you're not alone. There are times I've awakened to myself doing that too. Well, if you have, then the question is, what's the cure? How do we move past our pride that drives us to wage these designer water wars and denies and destroys community. This pride that leaves us alone, unhealed, and still in need. Well, first of all, it takes several things, but first of all, I think it takes getting over ourselves. In fact, you may have had somebody honest enough in your life at some point to say, you need to just get over yourself. I knew you when. Getting over ourselves to come to grips with the fact that we're not all that. And we need other people. Secondly, we need to open ourselves up to seek the one who can help us with what we can't do ourselves. Naaman came seeking healing from Elisha and his God. Third, we surrender our pride to submit ourselves to the one who can help. And as we submit, we obey their prescribed directions. Now, obedience is hard. I know obedience has been hard for me in my life. Maybe it has been for you. Maybe you're a much more well-rounded person than I. Obedience is hard, but submission is even harder. You see, a person, one's about external action, obedience. I can act externally and obey for any number of motivations, whether it's to avoid an unpleasant consequence, or whether it's to gain favor or advantage, and have no change in internally in my life. I can obey without submitting. It's an overt action. But the other, submission, is about internal state of being. I can obey without submitting, but I cannot submit without obeying. We can obey without submitting. If you question that, watch any 5-year-old child who gets in a tussle with brother or sister, and mom or dad steps in and says, now you make up, you shake hands, or give each other a hug, and you watch them go through the process. There is a whole visual battle as you watch the body language. If I don't obey, I'm going to pay a price. And so through clenched teeth, they say, I'm sorry. And then they go for the death grip to see who's going to be stronger as they shake hands. And the battle may be won for the day, but the war of pride goes on. Jill Briscoe, a wonderful Christian author, wrote in one of her books about a time when she was a little girl, maybe 5 years old, and she was acting up, and parents were getting tired of it, and she kept on doing it, and they were scolding her, and she got angry and made it worse, and I finally said to her in no uncertain terms, it's time for you to sit down and be quiet. And hearing the tone, knowing that if she didn't obey on the outside, she's going to pay a higher price, she finally plopped down. And then she said, I'm sitting down on the outside, but I'm standing up on the inside. We can obey without submitting. But we can't submit without obeying. And we can't submit without accepting and loving the one to whom we submit. We may think we are submitting, but if we don't obey, then the evidence is clear that we haven't. Jesus said to the disciples in the upper room that night before he was arrested and tried and convicted and executed. In the Gospel of John, the 14th chapter, he said, anyone who loves me will obey my teaching. My Father will love them, and we will come to them and make our home in them. Anyone who does not love me will not obey my teaching. These words you hear are not my own. They belong to the Father who sent me. If we are to submit and to submit in our love for the other, we obey what the other wants from us. We have to get past our need to have God act on our behalf the way we want him to do it, when we want him to do it, like Naaman's expectations that were unmet. to get past our designer water wars of pride. So are we ready to acknowledge our need, that we have need to know that we're unclean and broken? Are we ready to submit to God and live our lives as He calls us to live them? Or do we really have what it takes to be whole all on our own? And if we do, we don't have any need for God. And the issue of obedience and submission is out. If we aren't able to do it on our own, if we are broken, if we are in some way soiled, if we are ragged, we need somebody to make us whole. And the question comes about as far as submission and relationship and obedience. One day a man was touring a factory which produced some of the highest quality stationery in the world. And as they showed him the entire production process, he was really intrigued and was impressed. And then he said, well, what goes into making the best paper? And explained that it was the amount of rag content. The higher the rag content, the finer the stationery. And he wasn't sure what they meant. They took him to another room just off of the main process line, and there was this mountain of old rags of clothes. And they said, we use those to make the finest paper. And that just didn't connect with him. He couldn't understand that. He thought they were pulling his leg, and he left the whole day never fully convinced. About 6 weeks later, he received in the mail a package from the company that he had toured. And inside the wrappings, he found this box of stationery. And as he opened the top of the box, there was his initials embossed on top. They had sent him this ream of stationery. And written on the top page, the first page was, "Dirty rags transformed." It occurs to me that God's in the business of transforming dirty rags into the finest stationery in the world upon which He writes His love story to us and upon us to the world around us. It's never just about you getting a letter or me getting a letter from God. It's about being the letter to somebody else. God's business is to make that stationery in which He writes that letter to the world. And if we'll come to God just as we are, broken and in need, ragged and weary, God writes upon our hearts for all the world to see, even we ourselves. Dirty rags transformed.